So, Danny, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you here to Portsmouth this evening, and we're all looking forward to your lecture on what geography can teach us about inequality. Danny.
Thank you very much for that, and thanks for inviting me here tonight. I'm going to talk for about 45-50 minutes about a variety of issues that are all related to inequality and have some connection to geography. I should say that the maps you're going to see, the very weird maps, are not drawn by me. They're drawn by Ben Hennig, who I've worked with for many years, and the cartoons are by Ella Furness. I can no longer draw maps. I've never been able to draw cartoons. I'm going to try to show you why I think geography is becoming more interesting, particularly for human geography, because inequality is becoming more important. In a way, inequality for human geography could be the equivalent of climate change for physical geography. Climate change has made physical geography very important. Going up and measuring glaciers now matters, whereas when I was a student, it was something you did as an excuse to go for a walk. The graph there is GDP per head over time, and what you're seeing is the recession, the Great Recession we're currently in, and I'm going to come back to that later. If you're my age, you'll be able to remember the 1990s recession, the 80s recession, and even maybe the 70s recession. You can hardly see them on that graph. We are in a very, very dire, deep recession, but we've become used to it because it's gone on for several years. Some strange maps for you at first, stretch maps. Here's one of the world. This is the world where every human being is given the same amount of area, about 7.4 billion people there. India's very large, China's very large. And the arrows on it are showing the best estimates for human migration from the origins of our species to a few thousand years before the present day. Nobody finds migration in the past contentious. I've yet to meet anybody who says, why on earth did we ever leave Africa? Isn't it terrible? Couldn't we have stayed there? In fact, nobody worries too much about migration from 100 years ago or even 20 years ago. But they do worry, of course, a lot about migration more recently. There are contentious things to do with this map. The contention is all in the middle of China, which is why we haven't put any dates there, because it really annoys some of the Chinese scholars who have different ideas from other people about when human beings arrived and what kind of human beings arrived there. So one approach I have is to try to avoid controversy sometimes, if I can, but as you'll see, I don't try that hard all the time. But I'm not trying to upset people. However, let's put something up to get you going. First of all, this is a very similar map, but it's of all of Europe now. And again, we've stretched Europe so that everybody gets the same amount of space. Now the cities are large. In France, that big blob is Paris. In Spain, it's Madrid. Here in the UK, it's London. You can just about work out Portsmouth down on the south coast if you look quite carefully. The shading is dark blue if more than a fifth of the population were born in another country. This is the latest data from Eurostat, so I'm showing you the pattern of cross-border lifetime migration in Europe as best as it's known. The region in the middle of the continent with the highest proportion of cross-border migrants is Switzerland. That's a dark blue area there. Switzerland has a high proportion of migrants, not just because quite a lot of people want to go to Switzerland, because it's economically successful, but also because it's a long, thin country. I think David reminds here. The longer and thinner you are as a shape, the more migration you'll get. Right? If you are round and circular, the less you'll get. Migration tends to be higher into cities, and so you're seeing the cities of Europe are more often dark blue. Here, at least in England, Scotland and Wales, it's just London. It's really London, not even all of London, it's West London. That's where the migrants have largely come. The rest of the country has remarkably few migrants. You wouldn't know that from reading newspapers, you wouldn't know that from hearing political debates. You only know it from the numbers that tell you that this is not particularly high. It's higher than it was when I was a child, and it was higher than it was when my parents were children, because migration rises over time as it becomes easier to travel, easier to Skype back home, easier to fly cheaply back home. But we are not a country of particularly high migration. Ireland is, particularly Northern Ireland, originally because a lot of people born in the south of that island lived in the north, but increasingly because people came in from the rest of Europe, especially Eastern Europe, into Northern Ireland in recent years. The other area of Europe worth pointing out is here. This is Spain. This is the Costas. Lots of immigrants. You may know some of them. They may have decided that as lovely as Portsmouth is, they really wanted to spend their later years somewhere a little bit warmer and sunnier. And if you look at the shading, and the advantages of these maps is it forces you to concentrate on absolute numbers of people. You'll see it's as dark as London, and in fact more migrants than London. And if we're really lucky, they'll be coming home soon if they find that they no longer qualify for free healthcare in Spain. So we need to gear up to welcome all those lovely people back and deal with them. Inequality. A few weeks ago, the Office of National Statistics released some data saying that there'd been a small reduction in inequality between the best off 10th and the worst off 10th of the population. If you want to know if you're in the best off 10th, if your household, after you've paid tax, is getting more than £53,000 a year, that's you. There'll usually be more than one of you, almost always two of you. There are a few more exciting households than that, but not many. There you're in the top 10%. If your household is getting less than £13,000 a year, you're in the bottom 10%. That's the gap in this country. It's one of the largest gaps in Europe. And that gap between the 10th and the 10th has narrowed slightly. But, and I'm going to apologise now for the number of graphs that are coming up. I gave this lecture last night to a set of doctoral students who are training to be doctors of psychology, and they said that was too many graphs. So if you're thinking these are too many graphs and it's too complicated, it's not you, it's me. But they don't all matter. This one, along the bottom you've got that ratio for the person on the 90th to the 10th percentile, and when I was a child it was nice and low. Won't do that again. Less than 4 to 1. After Sweden, the UK was the second most equitable large country in Europe when I was growing up. It's now the most unequal country. The big rise happened between 1984, if you look closely, when it was 4 to 1, and 1990. 1984 is the miners' strike. They lost. Had they won, I think we'd have been a very different country, not the most unequal country in Europe. 1990 was when Margaret Thatcher resigned. That's the peak of that inequality. And the major, it got slightly better, ever so fractionally better under New Labour. But the line above it is what really matters, because the line above it is the take of the 1%. And they're not included in ONS's statistics, because they don't fill in the employment surveys. If you're in the 1%, you really don't waste your time filling in surveys. The only reason we know about the income of the 1% is from tax records. So we actually only know about the income of the 1% that they admit to actually having and paying tax on. Anyway, as that inequality fell in Britain from 1990, for most of the population, the 1% carried on taking more and more and more. You're probably looking at the end and going, oh, something's happened. Something definitely did happen around about 2010-2011. As yet, we do not know whether the 1% have actually started to take less, or if a large number of them increased their attempts to avoid paying tax. What we do know is that the tax rate went up to 50p. And at the point the tax rate went up to 50p and then was brought down to 45p, very, very large numbers of very well-off people registered companies with no employees and put their incomes through those companies at the same time. This is the kind of minutiae I worry about. It matters, or it's really interesting, because we could currently be at the peak of inequality now. The last peak of inequality was 1913. After 1913, the country became more equal for the next 60 years. Becoming more equal isn't necessarily great at the beginning. Right? The year after 1913 was not a good year. The 1920s were not a good decade. The 1930s were a pretty awful decade. People didn't notice that the gap was narrowing at that time. I'm going to try not be too pessimistic with you, but as optimistic as I try and be, whatever happens, the next 20 years don't look easy. But if you accept that they don't look easy, and that's even if we stop being the most unequal country in Europe, if we stop doing things that I think are silly, if we know it's going to be difficult, at least you could plan better for what's going to happen, rather than thinking we're suddenly going to become rich again and all's going to be great, because that looks very, very unlikely. Things go wrong when inequality falls. Lots of things begin to go wrong in society. You don't often notice they're going wrong because you're used to them. You become used to things very, very quickly. People became used to the Second World War, remarkably quickly into that war. War becomes normal. You've become used to cuts, enormous cuts. You've become used to the city council saying they can't do anything but try and keep adult social services going. You've become used to the idea that school classroom sizes are about to have to rise, that there isn't enough money for everything. But there's a danger in becoming used to things that quickly, because you don't notice what's gone wrong. I grew up in the city of Oxford. I was a bit of a rebel as a teenager. I thought the University of Oxford was the most elitist, horrible thing on earth in the 1980s. And so when I was 18, I went as far away from Oxford as I could and stayed in England. So I went to Newcastle-upon-Tyne to get away from the place. I thought there were obnoxious students at the University of Oxford who threw champagne glasses at local school children. And there were, if you work out the timing of when I was at Oxford, who was there. I came back 4 years ago to Oxford, and it's slightly, if you ever do this, it's like being a time traveller. If you've been in one place, leave it for 3 decades and come back, you get to see what's changed. And the kind of things that have changed in a city like Oxford is that there is now a house price gap between the catchments of all the state secondary schools of £100,000 per school. People are paranoid about the inequality inside the city in a way that wasn't as bad when I was young. It's now the most expensive city to live in Britain. It even beats London. Some things have got better. It's got 20 mile an hour on the roads. But things begin to go wrong and become more unequal. Let's show you some maps of America, because it's much more comfortable talking about somewhere else and its problems than talking about your place. Again, one of these maps, stretched. Everybody's given an equal amount of space. That's what the United States looks like in terms of people. It's New York, it's Los Angeles, it's Chicago in the middle, and all the dark areas and the rural areas that have been squeezed away because hardly anybody lives there. Hopefully I haven't upset you showing you this map, unless you're American. If you're American, you have the normal map of America on your classroom wall as you're growing up, and this map isn't particularly liked by many Americans. America does things differently. On the left side of politics, they're blue. You have to remember this. On the right side of politics, the Republican side, they're red. This little map down here is showing you Obama's victory in 2012. That's slightly more blue than red. The red stands out because your eyes see red and blue goes to the back because of the way your cones work. But believe me, there's a little bit more blue than red, and that's Obama's victory. Now I'm going to show you Trump's victory. Trump's victory is the red. You've got the normal map at the top, lots of red because rural areas more likely to vote Republican. The cartogram at the bottom, there is obviously less red than there is blue. Now you know that Donald Trump won, what was it, 3 million fewer votes if he won the Electoral College. What you may not realise is that in the areas that he didn't win, there are many more children. And of course they don't get a vote, so they're not being represented. There are also many more people who are not on the electoral register in the United States, who are not allowed to vote. So you really are looking at a president with remarkably little support across the country. But how did he get his support? And this is the kind of thing where geography ends up being the clue, I think often the vital clue. You mentioned Simon Jenkins earlier. Simon Jenkins thinks there's two Danny Dorlings. When he doesn't like what I do, he calls me a geographer and says I'm a geographer of the left. When he likes something I do, he calls me an economist. Which I think says more about Simon Jenkins and his idea there's two of us. But this graph comes from The Economist magazine. And it was their best attempt to explain the Trump victory. They looked for numerous correlations of what could explain why some areas saw a little increase in the Republican vote, just enough to get Trump in, and the areas which saw a decrease, which are the ones below the red line, were less. These areas are counties of the US, there are just over 3,000 of them. The circles are drawn larger if there are more people in the county to stop you looking at the tiny ones that matter less. And the y-axis of the graph is an index of health, poor health. And what you're finding is that essentially 90% of the folk was the same as 4 years ago. The shift towards Donald Trump was higher in those areas which have the worst health problems in the United States. That isn't voters with health problems. We know that individually Trump voters are more likely to be better off, more likely to be middle class, much more likely to be white, more likely to be male. But they were also more likely to be living in a county where things were getting worse. So around them, everything was going downhill. That's what they saw. People in those areas were much more likely to vote against the status quo for something very different. Whereas in those parts of the United States where health is improving, which are the areas down here, the swing away from Trump was higher. The status quo was okay. You'd go for a candidate like Hillary because business as usual was doing good for you. Things were getting better around you. For other people. What you have to remember when you look at this graph is that when we talk about health getting worse, in the United States, life expectancy stopped rising several years ago. The United States has the highest infant mortality in the rich world. Health is pretty awful in the United States for most people. Before you even mention health care and how you even get health care. So let's look at us. This is the Brexit vote, 23rd of June last year. Wonderful vote for one reason. It's a wonderful vote because it produces a completely new map. I see none of you are warned by this particularly, but believe me, this pattern has never been seen before. And if you spend your life drawing maps of Britain, you quickly become depressed by drawing a map of something else like exam results or mortality rates or house prices, looking at it and going, seen that before. They all look the same. They almost all begin to look the same. But not this one. This really is an interesting and new pattern. The yellow areas are the areas which voted Remain. The blue areas are the areas which voted Leave. The majority of the blue votes are in the south of England and Wales. Don't know if this thing works. It does work. Here's Middlesbrough. And on this map, we've actually covered it in by how strong the boats were, so darker blue for more likely. Sunderland, Middlesbrough don't matter. Really don't matter. They're too small. They didn't swing it. What swung it is all the blue down here. And that's the mass of votes. That was the unexpected thing to see. Yes, along the east coast you do get some of the darkest blue and a little bit down here as well. But the home counties, the southwest of England, that was strange. So what's going on? Now, nobody as yet has done the equivalent of what the economists have done for the US. Almost certainly because there isn't as neat a relationship in the UK to explain what has gone on as in the US. For a start, Scotland was voting about London. It wasn't really voting about Europe. It was quite happy with Europe because it wasn't happy with London. But that goes and upsets the maps. In the middle of London, people are very happy with the status quo. They're doing well, on average. In the middle of Oxford, there's Oxford, 70% remain. Cambridge, very happy. Why are they very happy in Oxford and Cambridge in the middle of London? Because if you're not happy there, if anything goes wrong in your life, you have to leave, because it costs so very much to live there. You can't be in those areas unless things are going well for you. There are other anomalies. Liverpool, and particularly Manchester, were interesting, so we don't have a clear map. But in most of the country, a narrow, even slightly larger proportion of people voted to leave. And I'd suggest that in most of the country, things are not good. That's what the map tells us. In most of the country, health is not particularly good. Not as bad as the United States, but I'm going to show you some evidence about health in a minute. But also, if you ask people questions about their lives, you know, about their grandchildren and what they worry about, they say, well, my grandchildren are never going to be able to get a mortgage. My children can't get a mortgage. How are they going to settle down? How are they going to have a family? It's all going wrong. And then, of course, people may blame migrants. They may say the reason you can't get a mortgage, the reason you can't get a house is because other people are coming and getting all the houses. But that isn't the reason why you can't get a house and you can't get a mortgage. The reason why you can't get a house and you can't get a mortgage is that somebody else has been buying all the houses. That somebody else has been buying all the houses, and you certainly notice if you live in Oxford or London, private landlords. The number of private tenants in this country has doubled in the last 10 years. If private landlords buy up houses when they go on the market, you can't get yourself a house, and somebody else has to pay rent all their life. Those private landlords are not migrants from Eastern Europe. Right? Some of you probably aren't those private landlords. And it's your only chance of getting a pension, because the pension schemes aren't working in the country. And the problem gets deeper and harder. But let me go back to health, because I think health hasn't been looked at enough to do with this. Do you remember back in 2010 when David Cameron was a fresh-faced young Prime Minister? He's about a year older than me. He was one of those people in Oxford who threw champagne glasses from college windows. And his funny blonde-haired friend was making restaurants in my hometown. Not that I hold a grudge. Anyway, 2010. David Cameron said everything was going to be different. He went and he hugged huskies. He tried to hug people with hoodies. And he announced that we were going to have a happiness index. You remember that? Right. Do you remember ever being told what the results of the happiness index was? Okay. It was measured every year. Now, it was a complicated collection of statistics that ONS came up with, but nobody ever took any notice at each of the announcements of the happiness index that happened about March each year. Nobody looked at them. This constantly happens in politics. people announce something and everybody forgets it because the next thing is announced. Now, among the statistics in the happiness index, the most important one from my point of view is the questions about people's health. How is your health? As you get older in life, I won't ask the people older than me to agree with me, but I hope you will. As you get older, your health and the health of your family and the health of people around you becomes more important than absolutely everything else there is. If you're young and you don't know this, you're lucky and enjoy it. Right? But it really is the case that health begins to dominate the important things in life. What these graphs are the proportion of the population who said in the Big Understanding Society survey, official statistic, 40,000 people, that they were completely satisfied with their health, which declines every year. This is 2010, 11, 12, 13. 2014, we only get an aggregate statistic combining some of these, but it's worse than ever. People who are somewhat satisfied, that declines. People who are mostly dissatisfied, huge increase in mostly dissatisfied, a doubling. And completely dissatisfied rises rapidly. When epidemiologists first saw this data, they said it's an error. This only ever happens by error. Somebody's gone and changed the sample. They've changed the survey. They changed the survey question. Or they just made a mistake and coded things differently. But as far as we can see, there has been no error. The population really did begin to feel more poorly. Now, why they felt more poorly is trickier to get to. There may be psychosocial effects that have a play with this. We know from many studies that political events can have an effect on how people feel. The suicide rate in the country fell after Tony Blair was elected in 1997. It's hard to remember back to 1997, but there were a few months of things can only get better and isn't it wonderful. And you really do have these kind of effects. Well, 2010, 11, 12, things didn't feel good for people. I think we ought to look into that because this happened in the build-up to that vote and it doesn't look dissimilar to what happened in the United States. This data was released on the 23rd of June 2016. It wasn't a conspiracy. 23rd of June 2016 was the date when ONS was scheduled to release the annual mortality statistics. 23rd of June 2016 was the worst date in history to release anything if you thought you were going to get any news coverage on it whatsoever. Because if you take your mind back to that time, you have a Prime Minister resigning, you then have Boris not standing, you then have a competition between two largely unknown politicians, one of whom drops out, and somebody else becomes Prime Minister without an election. Something happened every day, and this never got reported. An extra 52,000 people were found to have died in the year to summer 2015 than the year before. The rise of 52,000 was the largest rise I think we've ever had. And in terms of percentages, down at the bottom I've listed the largest annual percentage rises since death records were first reliably collected around about 1840. And the dates at the top, 1918 was the flu pandemic, that was very bad. 1846 was cholera. You have to go all the way down to 1951 to find one that's post-war, and that was a small flu epidemic. And 1968, which was again flu, and then you get 2015. But this list is calendar year to calendar year. If you go mid-year to mid-year, 2005 was bigger than those two dates. It was the biggest increase of death since 1940. And 1940 was the Luftwaffe bombing and men who came back from Germany who were then dying of their injuries. Right, this was a huge event that occurred in 2015. And it occurred after the population had been telling the statisticians that they were feeling more poorly in the happiness index. Here's another way of looking at it. This is divided by age that's relative, and so it's the increase in percentage rather than percentage points. But it's the elderly. It's people 85, people over 80 dying in high numbers. Initially, it was more elderly women. 2012-13, life expectancy of women over 65 dropped by about 5 weeks. The group whose deaths is least reported and noted are elderly women. I think it was elderly women initially because elderly women are much more likely to be living on their own than elderly men. Men tend to marry, particularly in this cohort, most people get married, tend to marry somebody about 5 years younger than them who lives 5 years longer than them. So men end up with a partner until they die more often than women do. What was going wrong? I remember I said it started in 2012, 2013, slight dip in 2014, but 2014 was still a bad year for mortality. 2015 was awful. Wasn't a cold winter. Thanks to global warming, we're getting the most remarkably warm winters at the moment. I should tell you, by the way, that deaths are up again. Really high in 2016, very high December 2016, January 2017. It's not a cold winter. It hasn't been a cold winter. It wasn't influenza, because we can test for influenza, and influenza peaks within 5 weeks, and this has gone on for months and months and months. The cause of death on the death certificates was Alzheimer's and dementia. But it wasn't a huge increase in people getting Alzheimer's and dementia, it was a big increase in people who had Alzheimer's and dementia dying earlier than people who had Alzheimer's and dementia used to die. Because our ability to care for people got worse. Adult social services visits to people's homes, those visits that people complain about, just 15 minutes. You knock on the door, you take your coat off, you put the kettle on, you make a cup of tea, you say hello, how are you, you put your coat back on and you leave, and you drive to the next old person. Half of those visits have been cut since 2010. They're pretty useless for most things, except for noting that somebody who's very old and frail is in a terrible state and something needs to be done about it. And if you halve those visits, that's trouble. Meals on Wheels have been more than decimated. Rural bus services have been hit. And before you get to anything to do with the NHS, which of course has been cut, despite what government tries to say about how the fact they think they're funding it. Okay. Before you even get to the NHS, before you even arrive on a trolley and then wait over 4 hours to be seen, there are big problems. I also think there are very big problems in care homes now. We looked at the geography of this, and I'm not going to show you any of the maps of the geography of this. We published that about a week ago, because there's no pattern. It's happened everywhere, slightly randomly, all at once. And when it happens everywhere, slightly randomly, all at once, you know it's not an epidemic, because they move and create beautiful maps of moving across the country. There were lovely maps done in geography journals in 1968 of the influenza pandemic then. It's when local care services are beginning to fail. It happens as much in affluent areas as poor areas, because affluent areas are absolutely full of 80-year-olds and people in their early 90s. Working class people on average don't get to live that long. This has been something that's occurred more to middle class people, because they got to live long enough to then suffer from not getting the services that they thought they would get. Here's the number of deaths per week of people over 75. The 2015 peak was dramatic. With three colleagues, we published two papers on Friday in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, where we looked at every possible reason we could find for the 2015 peak. And we concluded, because we had all the statistical series on how the health services were performing, that what happened around about November, December 2014, before you get to the first few months of 2015, was a system-wide failure of our National Health Service. When things begin to go really wrong in one hospital, it has effects in other hospitals, and the whole service began to fail, and it took it months to get back up to normal again. And as you'll see towards the end, it's rising up again. This is now being taken more seriously. But we've become used, in a way, to this thing. Things begin to go wrong when you're very unequal. Remember I said we're the most unequal country in Europe? That's by looking at the take of the 1% and the 10%. And you have a recession. Great inequality coupled with declining living standards is not good. This is a quote from Professor Michael Marmot, who was the former president of the British Medical Association. These kinds of things are not said in normal times. And he's worrying about children. I want to get you back to some geography, and then make sure we've got enough time for questions. Infant mortality rates. Very crude. I'll show you some more in a minute. And very low. These are incredibly good rates. This is the number of infants dying per 1,000 births in the first year of life. But still that big gap between some countries and others. It then translates, if you look at mortality under 5, I think we're in the worst 3 countries in Europe. One of the others is Romania. This shouldn't be like this. There's a few of these bubble graphs coming up, so I should tell you. The really interesting thing geographically are the bubbles that are not on the line. This isn't necessarily saying that inequality causes this, but whatever underlies both things, they are related. Singapore, if your eye is looking at Singapore and you're seeing Singapore and thinking, you can have quite high inequality and have a really low infant mortality rate. When we first saw that, we had a look at Singapore. In Singapore, there are 100,000 maids. These are the servants who middle-class people employ. The maid used to be pregnancy tested every 6 months. They're now pregnancy tested every 3 months. And you have to leave Singapore if you're pregnant. So the baby's never born. In fact, they're aborted. And if the babies are not born, the babies can't die in the first year of life. If you want to get your infant mortality rate really low, stop the poor having children. Singapore hasn't found out the solution to inequality and great happiness. Two more of these. Here, infant mortality again, but instead of having the US as one big circle, taking the 50 states of the US to show that the relationship carries on. The most unequal states, places like Alabama, are really high. Texas is really bad. And in Texas, infant mortality is increasing at the moment. Maternal mortality, mothers dying during pregnancy, has doubled in the last 4 years. At the same time, as 3/4 of clinics have been cut in Texas. Maternity clinics have been cut. The Texas authorities' response to this was to say, it's very complicated and we'll be able to look into it. It's patently obvious what's going on in Texas. Initially, the responses of the public health bodies in this country were, it is very complicated. Now the public health bodies have largely gone quiet, apart from the Department of Health, who still refuse to accept there's a problem. This graph over here is a bit more naughty, maybe, but interesting. Inequality along here, the take of the 1%, a long time ago, 1983, and voting for right-wing parties, far-right parties, if you call voting for Donald Trump far-right. And hence the US states are here. These are the European countries. Tend to line up, it's just an interesting idea to look at. The two which misbehave are Germany. Unusually low voting for far-right parties in Germany. You might understand why that is. And France. That's what's going to worry us in a couple of months' time. Why do the French not go down here when they should be on my nice little line to behave? There's a growing body of work that says that inequality is bad, and I'm not going to go through much of it because I'm determined to keep the time. I wrote a little book last year called A Better Politics. The book is free on my website. You can get a PDF, you don't have to spend any money. And in that book I tried to summarise all the work that's come out in the last 10 years, the sense of kind of thing that Benjamin Radcliffe is saying there. There are people who don't agree with this. There are people who think inequality is good, it rewards talent, everything gets better as you become more unequal. Wealth creators create more wealth, the rest of the population does wonderfully. The evidence is just not backing it up. That's the problem. And there's some really interesting relationships beginning to be found. We're almost at the end of the bubble graphs. I think I've got another two, and then that's it. Here's inequality again. This is all the countries to which we can get a measure for the proportion of people who cycle or walk to work. And it's at 50% in the Netherlands. It's quite high in Denmark and Sweden. Japan, it will be a bit higher, but people say they take the train, which they do, and forget to say that from the train station they then walk or cycle, but they use cars. And in the US, it's down to about 3%. The interesting thing about walking and cycling to work is that you cannot individually choose that much to do it, because how much you can walk or cycle to work depends on the housing system of the country you're living in. Depends on who decides to build cycle tracks to make it easier to cycle. A quarter of pensioners in the Netherlands cycle. Only 1% of our pensioners cycle. It's not because our pensioners are particularly unfit, although they are a little bit more unfit than those in the Netherlands, partly because they don't cycle. It's because this country isn't set up for cycling. When you do the same thing with smoking or alcohol use, you don't get the same patterns. Because you have more control over whether you smoke and more control over alcohol. But you cannot go out and paint a cycle lane on a road and redesign the housing and school system in the city you grew up in so that people don't paranoidly try and live to get to one school rather than another, or drive their children to schools, which happens in more unequal countries. In the United States, it's more extreme. One town in Texas, it's always Texas, a bit unfair. In one town in Texas, when there was a proposal to introduce pavements for the first time a couple of decades ago, the mayor of the town said no, because pavements were the beginning of the road to communism. you can come up with lots of these statements from the US. You can come up with amazing statements about how many people think they're going to be in the 1% and so on. The majority of the population oppose what they call death taxes, believing that they or their children might one day pay them. But they've got no chance. The reason I don't do many of these statements is that the way we look at the US and say, that's terribly wrong, how can you think that? The gap between us and the US is the same size as the gap between mainland Europe and us. And I have a horrible feeling that all those polite Swiss and German and French people looking at us and shaking their heads and not saying anything, just looking to do it. Last two bubble graphs, and then I'll try and bring it to a close. It's always indicative, but they're just interesting, and it's only geography can do this. If you're wanting to test society-wide factors, you're stuck with geographical data for countries. The problem is that we only have, and this is rich countries you largely look at, only about 25 rich countries. You can take the states of the US and take them individually. I think that's fair to do, and that gets you up to 70, which is a much nicer number. But it's just a rough way of putting it. Again, along the bottom of the graph, you've got inequality. Along the side, you've got the PISA measure of ability in maths at age 15. And you'll see that Japan and South Korea, and annoyingly Singapore, really good at maths. But the way in which they make their children really good at maths is not necessarily a good way. United States, Greece, actually. United Kingdom, we're low. We're not so good. You get the same for problem solving, the same for literacy. But the reason I've shown you is not because this graph is particularly impressive. It's for the next graph. This is the PISA test at age 15. Suppose we test people's maths. We could do it now. Suppose we test them a little bit later, age 16 to 24. When you test young adults about their ability to do maths, it all lines up. If you spend your life drawing these things, it's when you get something like this, you go, yes. Now, you partly get something like this out of chance. It won't really line up as good as this. It's chance. PISA results came out a few months ago, but they didn't include pests of young adults in the latest ones, so they left for the 2012 ones. So what's going on? And I think this is just a nice example of the kind of complicated things that go wrong when you become more unequal. Why do our young adults not know maths? Can you put your hand up if you're under 25, so we've got an idea? Okay, keep your hand up if you got an A or a B at maths GCSE. You all kept your hands up. Keep your hand up if you got an A. Keep your hand up if you got an A star. Right, that's you. Well done, put your hands down now. It's the boys, I'm going to want to know what the school is in a minute. Okay, do you feel that sense of slight embarrassment there about it all? Yeah, about the body. Now, here's the bad news for you. Although you're still relatively young, but what this is saying is that your A star isn't as good as you think it is. In this country, we teach people in particular to get A's and A stars and C's, which are really vital, but you often don't end up coming to a lecture at night and an evening if you've got a C or a D. We teach people to get C's or A's and A stars because it really matters later. For getting a basic job that isn't the most menial job, that's what the C in maths gives you, or giving you a slightly better chance of getting into the university you might want to get in, that's what the A or A star does. So we teach children to get the maximum grade they can at age 15 or 16. Most of whom will never use maths again, won't do maths A level, won't do science A levels. And if you look at what teachers do in the classrooms of our schools, they do exactly what they have to do for the curriculum. They are not allowed to deviate from it because the teachers are judged by the exam grades that their children get. A very good friend of mine got an A in maths some time ago, said GCSE. She couldn't do fractions at all, so her school taught her how to memorise every possible fraction that had ever come up in the GCSE paper and what decimal it resulted in. She got an A, because what matters is the grade. Why does the grade matter more in the UK and the USA? Because these are the two most unequal countries in the rich world. So your exam results at 15 and 16 and then at 18 determine whether you're in the top half or the top 10% of a highly unequal country, which means you can at least have a reasonable life, or whether you're going to be in the bottom half, which means you're going to be much poorer than most people in Europe. In other countries, and back when we were more equitable in this country, it didn't matter so much where you ended up. Parents could be a bit more relaxed about things. Teachers could teach in a different way. You could actually teach people to enjoy mathematics. This is what's going on in that big cluster of countries up there. Whatever they're doing, they're teaching mathematics and other things in a way that means it sticks. This is what I think is really interesting about geography and inequality. It's not the more simple things like poor health and so on. It's these things that you didn't necessarily expect to find. That looks very colourful, but it's completely useless. Completely useless. It's exactly the same data as that. But that does tell you something more useful. This is a graph produced by the subversive organisation, the International Monetary Fund. And it shows the proportion of GDP spent on public services each year for all these countries. You're often told that there's no alternative. Everywhere's becoming more unequal. Everywhere has to cut back. We are currently heading towards 36% of our GDP on public spending. IFS said it might be 37, and they had a big deal about it recently. Here's all your other options. If anybody ever presented them to you as an option, but they don't. They don't tell you that it's possible to spend half of your GDP on public services. If you want really good schools, which is what they have in other countries in Europe because they spend more money on them. If you want a good health service, the Swiss spend twice as much per head on their health than we do. We spend the least in Europe, apart from Greece, at the worst of the crisis in Greece per head on our health. When you have
an economic crisis like 2008 and 2009, what were they doing in Finland, and not just Finland? They increased the amount
of money, the proportion they spend on public services, so the public services don't get worse, despite the country having become poorer. Can you imagine doing that?
Instead, we did this. By the way, the spike for Ireland
is because they followed our advice about bailing out every single bank account in Ireland. That's how much it cost them to keep the banks going in Ireland.
And the USA is down here. So we're very, very similar.
And we're not like the rest of Europe. So we have 9,000 heading towards £10,500 a year student fees, rather than having education free at the point of use, or tiny fees on the mainland at the conference. Fees that won't be paid back in the majority of cases. Fees that may end up wrecking the credit rating of the whole country, because graduates are not going to be earning that much in the future. Over half of all young women in Britain go to university. Well, you're going to have to really decrease the wages of men dramatically if you're going to pay that majority of women as much as graduates in the past got, when there were so fewer graduates and they were mostly male. It's not going to happen. Taking back control. That's soon through a bit, as we know. That's all about how great France is, but you probably don't want to read that. It's not written for you, it's written for the French. Try to tell them, you're lucky, you're in a country that's very nice. You have higher average incomes per household than we have in the UK. You could all stop working on a Friday and you'd still be as productive as we are. You get many times more hospital beds than we have. Stop complaining to the French. It's not for you. A more equal country looks more like this. Like even the most equal countries in Europe, like Denmark, you still have the best of 10, having four times more than the worst of 10. But if you're at the top, you don't have an incredible fear of falling, because you can't imagine what life's like at the bottom. The middle class of this country have no idea what job seekers' allowance is, or how much they would get on benefits, because they could not live on benefits. In more equal countries, your benefits can support you, they're often a proportion of your salary up for 2 years. There's Ellen's cartoon of a more unequal country. It's pretty dire at the bottom, but as you head towards the top, it doesn't actually get much better, because above you, people are always so much better off than you. So you don't have a group of happy people at the top of an unequal country. If you want to see this, go to Brazil, the most unequal country in the world, and go and look at Brazilians in the top 10% of the population in Brazil, and ask why they still are walking around with their backpacks on the front of their bodies rather than the back, because they're scared somebody's going to rob them, and why they have bars outside their houses. Just to stir you up before we ask questions, take back control. You have to ask who actually has control. The Take Back Control slogan was derived by Matthew Elliott. Matthew Elliott was the CEO of the Leave campaign. Matthew Elliott used to work for the Taxpayers Alliance. Taxpayers Alliance is not funded by taxpayers. Taxpayers Alliance is funded by a small number of very rich people who don't like paying taxes. That's where Take Back Control came from. This is UK voting. I said I have too many maps, but it's as disjointed as US voting. The purple areas, over 50% Conservative voting. The dark red areas, less than 5% Conservative voting. We are now more polarised geographically by how we vote, at least in terms of the Conservative Party and its predecessors, than at any time since 1832. We have the highest segregation index of voting we have ever had. It used to be 1918, the Carkey election of that year. The last election was the most segregated ever. It beat 1918. This is a highly, highly divided country. This was the last budget. We're going to get another budget soon. This was George Osborne's last one. And that's how much people won from handouts in the budget. So more money went to the best of 10. This had nothing to do with the EU. The EU didn't say you've got to give more money to the rich. the UK didn't become the most unequal country in Europe because it joined the EU. We've done this internally for some reason. The question is, why have we done it internally? The kind of things I think are necessary, and they seem a million miles away now, but imagine you're sitting there in 1913, or even 1919, or even 1925, or 1926, or 1936, and thinking what on earth might be possible. You wouldn't think that what might be possible is what actually happened. Things are really bad when you're in a recession and when it's very unequal. I think we should tax at a normal European level, if we want normal European standards. It wouldn't hurt anybody, because taxing is not like theft. They take the money off everybody else like you. So the house prices come down in the same kind of house you might want to get. We should spend on education and health at normal European levels if we want decent education and health. We should have normal laws for tenants, which we don't have. You can be evicted with 2 months' notice in this country. It doesn't happen in the rest of the continent. A basic income may sound fanciful, but there are experiments all over Europe just beginning on a basic income, and there's an experiment in Scotland. They're doing lots of things in Scotland differently as they prepare for something else. Student loans, almost half the population, not quite half, because the children, the best off 5%, don't have a student loan. They may not realise this, their parents pay up front. That's why student loans came in, because it's actually cheaper for the very rich if everybody else has to borrow money than if they have to pay normal European levels of taxes for free education. But for the poor, we have sanctions. At the peak in 2013, we sanctioned 1 million people in this country for benefit infringements, and the amount of money we fined them was more than the entire fines for every criminal offence undertaken in England and Wales, or in sheriff's courts, fines in Scotland combined. The most unbelievable thing happened with sanctions. Normal country, a more equal country, has a fair voting system. Unequal countries tend not to. We don't. The US is even less fair. And lastly, our 1% is taking a seventh of everything. Now, things go badly wrong when your 1% takes so much. I told you that we became more equal in the 1920s and 30s. The two significant countries that became dramatically more unequal in the world were Germany and Japan in the 1930s. Inequalities in those two countries rose. It's always bad news when inequalities rise. I think Brexit is a continuation of a series of crises this country has had, since at least the Suez crisis. Suez was when we suddenly realised the Americans were not going to back us up and we were no longer going to be able to control an empire. Things got better after the Suez crisis. People forget this. This is Harold Wilson's 1964 postcard. It's the least depressing of Lowry's pictures. There's some people skating in it. It's a pond in 1950. Things do get better. They frequently get better. They have to get better as much, if not slightly more, than they get worse. But they don't get better while a large proportion of the population, particularly people at the top, think that somehow they're going to be fine. You have to get to a point of people thinking, particularly people in the top 30, top 10%, realising that this is bad news for them if it carries on. More difficult, you may have to get to a point of realising that you cannot carry on getting richer forever. Although our GDP fall is bad, the whole of Europe is relatively poorer than it was, North America as Japan is. We've seen the biggest decrease in worldwide inequalities in the last 200 years, in the last 10 years. Very good worldwide, but if you're in the country that's becoming relatively poorer, while China is becoming richer, while India is becoming better off, it doesn't feel great that the world's becoming more equal. But the world cannot become more equal if the richest countries carry on getting richer. It doesn't work, there just isn't enough stuff. And it also doesn't work to sell people social mobility. So don't worry about inequality, as long as we give you a chance, as long as somebody from the bottom has a chance of getting to the top, all will be fine. That's just more precarity. And for everybody who goes from the bottom to the very top, somebody has to come down to the top, towards the bottom, or lots of little people have to move a little bit down, all feeling they failed, to make up for that one going down. And social mobility is lowest in the most unequal countries, because people try really hard to look after their children and stop them falling. So they stop their children doing jobs they might want to do, such as nursing, because the pay would be too low, and they can't stand the idea of them having that kind of life. That's a terrible situation to get into, where you stop people doing things that are useful because they're not paid enough. Why us? Why the United States? Because we're different. We've had a different history. The US has been the global power. In the 1950s and 60s, it had an enormous share of world GDP. It could do things then that it cannot do now, and it's very, very hard to adapt towards it slipping slowly towards the normality of the world. For us, we began that slipping earlier. We owned all of this 100 years ago. We were the richest country in the world. Whichever country has been the richest in the world finds becoming a normal country really difficult. It is understandable. We shouldn't beat ourselves up about it. But we should not carry on with some fantasy that somehow this thing is going to return. The quicker we begin to realise that's not going to happen, and that you can have a good future without being the richest place on the planet, the more likely we are to begin to sort all this out. Thank you very much for putting up with me. Yeah, we've got time for a few questions. I promise to keep my answers short if you keep the questions short. At the back.
In the news this week, there have been plans announced about cuts to the NHS and closing hospitals. What do you think about that?
What do I think about it? I'm going to zip right back very quick. The problem with closing hospitals, I've got my data. That's showing how many thousand people are aged over 75 and how many there will be 2018, 19, 20. And the percentage figure on the side is the annual rise. Aging has not yet happened because we had so few babies in the 1930s. The last baby boom year was 1946 and early 47, 9 months after the men came back from the war. They're now aged 71. They're fit. As they age, we've got a problem. The peak year of aging is 2022, where we get a 5% increase in over 75s. So we need to now be planning for a rapidly aging population that has not yet aged, let alone those people coming back from Spain. I mean, I'm trying to think, what cunning person sitting in the mainland of Europe said, you know, let's send the old people back to Britain and get all those young, highly qualified people back out of Britain. But anyway, so the cutting of inefficient district hospitals is silly because we're going to need them because of what's coming up. What annoys me about this is it's in the direct personal interest of the politicians who are doing the cutting, particularly the older ones, to actually see this. It's in their own interest. They're more likely to have aged parents because they just have had richer upbringings. I promise to keep my question short, so I will. But the NHS is very, very efficient. It could be more efficient if we remove some of the market from within it, and there's other ways which you can improve. You cannot fund the health service so very lowly and expect it to work. Question?
Part of the problem is that we've never actually agreed as a society what sort of society we want. I mean, your examples of the high spending GDP of all high tax countries, aren't they? Mainly the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
You know, I agree with your presumption about PR, because I think a lot of those countries have decided we're going to have a high tax country and we're going to have a high spending economy. Yeah. Whereas here, we tend to swing from one side to the other. I mean, part of the problem, we all want more health care, we all want better health care. damage it was, people are very reluctant to pay for it.
Yeah,
no, they all want, it's a bit like tax avoidance, isn't it? Tax avoidance is terrible unless you're one of the people. It's a scheme that you're actually able to take part in. Yeah. When it's,
or you're paying the bill with cash in hand, and then it's not you. Yeah, the question is, why haven't we decided what kind of country we want to be? George Orwell said it in 1948, I think, that the British working class do not understand they're getting a welfare state because we still have the remnants of empire. We were still making money from unfair terms of trade with India, where we decimated their textile trade. That we could do this, if you like, on the back of people outside of this country. We've always told ourselves a myth that the empire was a great burden to us, the white man's burden, and it was hard work, and we did it for the good of the world. We've never, and I'm sure that everybody who runs an empire does this, we've never told ourselves we did very well out of having an empire and being the centre of it. That's why all those big buildings in London that look very nice, you know, the Victorian Albert Museum, all that lot, why were they all built then? Where did the money come from? So we didn't have to have this discussion because we had that income. And then in the 1970s, we lost the last of our empire and the last of the unfair terms of trade, which lagged. But we didn't put our economic problems in the 70s down to that. We put them down to our trade unions. Also, we didn't realise that what made us different from other European countries was that we had lost something. And we still have to have that discussion. The other thing to say about other European countries is that the tanks rolled over them and back again. And there's nothing to being invaded, I think, has an effect on the country and hasn't happened to us. So some of the families who were given land by William the Conqueror still have that land. We haven't had a redistribution. And the countries which changed the most were Germany and Japan. And when you lose a war is when your elite really lose power. And Germany and Japan didn't come together and decide to be like this. It's because they lost. The Americans handed out land in Japan as equitably as they could amongst the Japanese because they were fearful of a communist revolution. What they gave us was the world's best experiment in what happens if you make everybody as equal as you can. And the Japanese now live the longest. They have the shortest lives in the rich world in the 1930s. Question? Mind you, yeah. Yeah.
Isn't going back to the 1% and the 5% quite often to explain the problems? For example, if you're in the 1% or 5%, you probably say your children are private schools, so why do you want to pay more tax for schools? Yeah. If you're in the top 5%, you can afford to have your own, pay for your own hip operation. So are you really wanting to pay more for the NHS? Yeah. And isn't it increasingly coming to that? And I see quite a lot of younger people when they earn a lot are now actually what's in it for me, and they don't want to put their money into an insurance fund which pays out when you need it. And it seems to me that the only time in the NHS that they will need it is perhaps when they need intensive care, and they will take that one without being free.
Yeah. This is the, you've been amazed how well off you have to be safe. So you really want to be in the 1% of being this kind of good. And even in the 1%, if you're a young person in the 1%, that's an income of 160,000 a year. In London, you can't buy a three-bed house in Fulham because it costs a million. And they won't give you a mortgage for a million on 160. So people in the bottom half of the 1% actually have problems, which is hard to imagine. About half of the 10% go private. Almost all the 1% go private. But amongst those half of the 10% who are going private, a large number of people are really struggling to pay the fees. The bottom end of people who are going private can only just afford to go private. Grandparents giving them money, something else is happening. So they're not doing it comfortably. When it comes to health, private hospitals are not particularly good at dealing with things that are really important. Damage you, but people don't know that, so they take out the insurance for it. But younger generations have become more individualistic, have been told if you work hard, you'll be okay. This culture of examinations, we've got them to compete more and more. The problem is that you won't be safe. There is no private A&E. You don't have a private A&E. So your chances of surviving a bad car accident, which is the most likely thing to happen to you under the age of 40, it's bad. Over 40, it's heart attack. But don't worry about that. Under 40, it's a car. Your chances of surviving a bad car accident should depend on the quality of the A&E and intensive care beds, and that's all state provided. Cancer treatment is long and tricky, but you also want medics who are not also operating for profit. You know, that there is a problem of having a health service which operates for profit. So in the United States, they spend twice as much than we do on health, the highest in the rich world, and have the lowest life expectancy. A health service that operates for profit is not that good. The very, very richest in the United States live a fraction longer than the richest in Scandinavia, with huge amounts of money spent on them. However, it is in the interest of the private hospitals to keep them alive, and sometimes in any state. So in a coma, but living, you can charge, you know, the insurance fund. A private health service does not necessarily have your interests at heart. It has the interests of the profits of the hospital at heart. And that's scares me. Well, I'm taking all from there. Is there anybody laying in the back?
One of the arguments against increasing taxation is the idea that people will leave the country because they'll move to tax havens elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah, where they go. We've got 3,000 bankers paid over €1 million a year. So one argument is that these bankers would go somewhere else. The problem is that there isn't anywhere for them to go. So Germany has the next highest number of high-paid bankers, and it's 197. So there aren't any high-paid bankers' jobs in the rest of Europe. There are in New York, but the American bankers probably don't want to give up their jobs for the British bankers. So that's one argument about it. The other argument is, you know, if people really did leave, how come all these high-taxing European countries are doing okay? And they might be doing okay partly, and okay means better health, better schools, better productivity, better factories. Maybe the more selfish Germans are coming here. Maybe we're getting the French people who don't like high taxes, and they come in this country.
Well, that's why he was here the other day, trying to get them all to go back.
His kids come back, and come back from London. All is forgiven. What's really good about? You know, I mentioned tenancy controls and rent controls. Paris is very lucky because they have rent controls in Paris. So the influx of British bankers coming into Paris shouldn't cause a housing boom and make life impossible for them. And Frankfurt and the other places where they're going. It doesn't happen. That's my answer. You don't see this flight away. People become used to paying higher taxes very quickly for what they get. There's an American economist called Robert Frank. Robert Frank wrote the main economics textbook with Ben Bernanke, best-selling textbook. Academics are slightly obsessed with best-selling textbooks because that gets you to the Caribbean island. But Robert Frank doesn't live on the Caribbean island, but he does have a yacht. And he's also written a book called Success and Chance, in which he tries to explain why Americans should accept higher taxes. And he explains it because all Americans would pay it. So he has to pay a mooring fee for his yacht. But if taxes rise for everybody, the mooring fees would fall. You have exactly the same number of spaces to moor your yachts as before. You wouldn't be worse off. The house prices at the top fall. The reason why you have houses worth £3 to £10 million in London is we have a group of people who are paid so much in London. It's not just the people from abroad. If top pay came down in London, the cost of those houses would come down. The houses wouldn't look any worse. In fact, some of the houses look truly awful. If you walk around central London and look at some of the houses in the poshest parts of London, you'll see they're semi-derelict, they're empty, nobody's living there. Nothing's being done to them, they don't bother to repair them because they're just worth so much, you leave them alone. But
Would you agree that the reason we didn't fall off an economic cliff at the end of empire, and that we've been reasonably prosperous ever since we joined the EU, has nothing to do with the EU, it's because of the North Sea oil, and that's why we have stayed relatively rich. And what's going to happen now that North Sea oil is declining?
What happens when it goes?
And gas. Yeah.
The North Sea oil helped, but it partly allowed Margaret Thatcher to cut taxes so very fast because the oil revenue was coming in at the same time. There is some oil left, and we find as the price of oil will go up in the future, people will find ways to get a bit more out. I got asked recently about, you know, the Scottish-English border is a kind of diagonal line. I got asked about how you draw it into the North Sea. My desperate attempts to draw it very, very high up so that England can somehow claim some oil fields. That oil won't matter. The oil allowed us to drop taxes really fast. The sad thing is we didn't do what they did in Norway, which is put the profits into a sovereign wealth fund, which now not only looks after the future of Norwegian people, it also pays the United Nations social reports. Half the funding just comes from Norway's oil sovereign wealth fund, helping the UN do that. Sadly, the other half comes from Bill Gates. There are other ways of getting that rich. But that's because Bill Gates is so incredibly wealthy because the United States is so incredibly unequal. Should I just take one more? Okay.
You said at the start that for human geographers, inequality can be equivalent to what climate change is for physical geographers.
Yeah.
Why do you think, and perhaps if you're allowed to put it like this, people haven't really got it before?
Why haven't they got it? It's similar to not getting climate change. You don't get things quickly. When I did geography at school, I was taught that an ice age was coming. We really did think we were going to get colder. And physical geographers used to go up to glaciers to measure them to see how fast the ice age was coming. And because people didn't think very much of geographers back then, and so they felt a bit sad, nobody thought them as proper scientists, and you'd like to go for a walk in the Alps, it's nice. And it took, I'm being a bit unfair to my cousin physical, it took them about 10 years of going up every summer and finding the glacier had retreated to actually go, actually this thing really is retreating, it's not an error, it's going backwards. And it's partly by accident that geographers found themselves as part of IPCC and then suddenly go from being a discipline that was a bit seen as what the PE teacher teaches when he's not doing PE. There's some colleagues from geography here. Geography fell in importance because it was created 100 years ago in this longer, but it was created 100 years ago in this country to train colonial officers. The reason we created geography departments was we needed to teach people how rivers and mountains and tribes and societies worked because they were going to be sent out to run them. When you lose your empire, you don't need any colonial officers anymore. We suddenly had a discipline, rather like anthropology, which was our sister discipline, which didn't have a purpose. Geography could have died. It hasn't died, partly because the science part of it, physical geography, has risen with this. With human geography, people were writing about the importance of inequality in the 80s and 90s. Hardly anybody noticed. The Spirit Level book came out in 2009-10. That was the best-selling social science book of that year. It's become very big. But the main reason we didn't notice the importance of inequality is it's only in the last 20 years that this gap between rich countries has got so wide that we've got the natural experiment that allows us to test the importance of inequality. Back in the 70s and 80s, all these countries were much more similar to each other, and so we didn't have the experiment and we couldn't do it. In the last couple of years, you've had the president of China, you had Obama, you had the Pope saying this is the worst problem. For years, Davos had it in its top three problems. Davos, and these are the world's business leaders, and not the nicest people in the world, Davos this January only had one problem. The only problem they wanted to talk about was inequality. That was it. That's the point we've actually got to, because they're scared witless of Donald Trump. But also because they can see how badly wrong things are going in the US and the UK. And they're obsessed by the US and the UK. And they don't see there's other parts of the world which have much lower inequality, which is where I think we need to look at to understand how you do things better. And one big problem of being a very unequal country is you tend to also get very bullish about how great you are as a country, and then you don't tend to go and look at other places to learn from, because you tell yourself that you're absolutely brilliant as you're slowly thinking down socially. Thank you very much for having me.